One of the most important points Swami Vivekananda makes here is, what is the goal of Karma Yoga at our present stage of development? It is the development of character. And what does he mean by the development of character? He means the development of will. As we have mentioned, by the word will, we should not mistake what we call stubbornness. We use force to do certain things upon which we set our mind. That's not the meaning of willpower. Will, in Vedantic terminology, is an expression of the self, of the divinity. So in that context, what it means is, the more we express our divinity, the more we become people of character. So why is it that we do not succeed in manifesting our divinity, in unfolding our divinity? That is where Swami Vivekananda's second chapter comes in, and he begins with that, what is the difference between one human being and another human being, one animal and another animal, one plant and another plant? You may think, probably there is no difference among animals. Have you seen dogs? There are some dogs, what we call good dogs, means good for nothing dogs. Even if the thief comes there also, they will just wag their tails and then sit inside. But there are some dogs, even if they spot a man 100 miles away, they start barking. So what is it that makes the difference? It is what Vedanta calls guna. Everything in this universe is created or is manipulated by the manifestation of guna. It is a very difficult word to translate. It is the very constituent of our body and mind. So there are three types of qualities: tamas, rajas and sattva. You know, in modern days, these days, all sorts of hybrid things are available, hybrids. What does hybrid mean? Hybrid means a plant that is, or an animal that is bred with the best characteristics so that it can manifest. It's a very interesting concept that you take both parents, male and female, but take best of both. That which has got the best qualities, for example, mango. You know, mangoes are either very sweet or not sweet. Those which are sweet, very small, a little bit of pulp, and do not last long. Which are sour, huge mangoes and plenty of them, and disease resistant, and they will be lying there on the tree untouched even by monkeys for a long time. Now, how to combine the best of these things so that it will be very sweet, very flavorful, and at the same time it will be plentiful, disease resistant and stays for a long time? And they have produced one such, I am very happy to say, in India. It is named as Chandrika. Anyway, coming to our point, what is this hybrid? The best of the qualities. This is the idea even among marriage. You know, you just marry so that good qualities from both parents will be manifested in the offspring. This is the idea of breeding, good cows, good dogs, good anything. Same thing applies also to human beings. You know, in the olden times, these Englishmen used to be very lean and tall and practically useless, like P.G. Woodhouse's books. So there was a cartoon once, you know, a tall and lean and thin lord was breeding some bulls. So he was breed one such bull, which is very short, very fat, very long and admirable. and he was looking with great admiration at the bull. And the bull was looking at him and telling, "My lord, if you had chosen your parents as carefully as you had chosen mine, you also would have been in a better condition today." Is it true? Yes, it is true. We choose our parents, we choose our country, we choose our religion. That is according to the karma that we do in the past. This shows to us that we have a choice always. And this is directly connected with the subject we are discussing. So there are three qualities, gunas we call it. Tamas, that is inertness, darkness, inertia, stupidity, etc. Rajas, intense activity, restlessness of the mind. Mind is full of desires. And sattva, where the intelligence just shines through. It is very rational, it is very balanced, and it is able to take right decisions. So the idea is gradually move away from the lower quality and manifest the higher quality. This is what life ultimately makes us do. This is called evolution. So this is the difference between one human being and the other human being. And depending upon this understanding, in India, the caste system has come. What we call, there are two types of what is called dharma or duty, roughly translated duty. It is, dharma is not duty. Dharma is how to live life. How to live life depends upon at what stage we are, what is our mindset, and at what age we are, and depending upon that, our goals, our duties are prescribed. Mainly, there are two types of these rights and duties. That is, one is called according to birth. Hindus, you know, they believe in past births and future births. Yes, Hindus, you know, always believe in reincarnations. There was a fellow who was working in an office. And there happened to be a great cricket match one day, one afternoon. So he was a great fan of cricket and he wanted to watch it. But his officer was very strict. He wouldn't grant any leave. So he went to his officer and said, "Sir, my grandmother died. I want leave for the afternoon. Funeral has to be conducted." So the officer naturally immediately granted leave. This fellow went away happily and enjoyed the cricket game. Next morning he came, very happy face. So the officer called him and said, "Are you a Hindu?" He said, "Yes." "Do you believe in reincarnation?" He said, "Yes, sir. Every Hindu believes in reincarnation." "Ah, that explains it." Man was puzzled. "What explains what, sir?" "Well, you see, after you left for your grandmother's funeral, she came along to see you. I couldn't understand how the dead grandmother had again come back. This theory of reincarnation explains it." So, what we are depends upon what we did in the past, whether we are poor or rich, intelligent or dull, or born in a good family or not such a good family, in which country we are born, in which we are, environment we are born. This is all determined by not anyone else but by ourselves. Now, one of the greatest causes of stress in the modern times is work and relationship. Work and relationship. Now, the modern business houses, they do not understand this division of human beings into these three categories, tamasic, rajasic and sattvic. They believe every human being is capable of doing anything. So you see, any educated person, they are brought into the office and they said, "Okay, this is the work you will do, this is the pay we give you." And they expect everyone to be able to achieve the same goals. Naturally, because of the differences in these qualities, some people they can do, some people they just manage, some people cannot do it at all, and it creates all sorts of stress. So work is one of the greatest causes of stress. What is the second greatest cause of stress is relationship. Relationship means how we relate ourselves. And there are three areas in which we relate ourselves. How we relate ourselves with ourselves. How we relate ourselves with our family members. And how we relate ourselves with society. And there are also other categories. How we relate ourselves with a particular religion, with a particular guru, with a particular aspect of God. You may think, what is this relationship can exist only between two different objects or persons? Is it possible to have for the same person to have a relationship with himself? Yes, because we are as the multiple personality. Most of us suffer from multiple personality syndrome, and it is a great matter of for conflict. And until we really resolve it, we will be paying quite an amount of price for that. I will give you a small example. Supposing you are a devotee of God, and you are taught, if you are a devotee, you are a spiritual person, you must observe certain principles in life. But suppose you are forced to go, say in an office or somewhere, and work in a different way, where that style of life comes into conflict with your beliefs. How are you going to resolve them? For example, I will give you a real example how this works. When Holy Mother was alive, she used to receive letters from various of her disciples and devotees with so many problems and begging her blessings and her advice, suggestions, etc. One of her disciples had written a letter to her. Mother, I am working in a merchant's office and I am forced to tell a lie. And Sri Ramakrishna taught us that in this age, truthfulness is the highest austerity, highest spiritual discipline. So I am forced to tell lies and it is contrary to my belief and Sri Ramakrishna's teaching. I want to resign. I want your advice. Immediately mother made one of her attendants reply to that disciple, do not resign. Continue even if you have to tell lies. The reply was sent and the attendant had a conflict. And he said, how can a holy mother, a spiritual person, advise another spiritual aspirant to tell lies even though he wants to follow the way of truthfulness? Of course, mother, you know, holy mother, she can read our mind. She knows our past, our present, our future. For 2-3 days, she didn't say anything. But after 3-4 days, she called him and said, my child, do you know why I have given this reply? Today, in an emotional way, he says, I have to tell lies and I will resign. And he is a householder. He has a wife, he has children. And tomorrow, if he doesn't get a job and his children are starving, then he might even take to worse sins like committing robbery or even murder. Which is better? Telling a simple lie, white lie as we call it, or a fib, or to commit robbery or murder? She was far seeing. This kind of conflicts arise in our minds. You know, there are devotees, I know, they don't want too much of money, they don't want promotions. If they get quite enough for leading a simple life. They will be very happy. Do you think they will be left undisturbed in their offices with this kind of ideology? They have to be up and compete and prove themselves. And if they do not, then there will be a repercussion. They may be asked to resign, they may be thrown out. Though you don't have what you call an ambition, you don't show enthusiasm, and all these things. So that is one area where it's there are vast differences among human beings, between human beings. So if somebody is calm and quiet, wants to lead a simple life, and he is not able to compete, and if he is not fortunate, if his aunt, 10 times removed aunt, has not left him with a huge inheritance, then there are going to be problems. This is one. Second is relationships. You know, most of the problems now between boss and employee, and between husband and wife, and between parents and children, between teachers and students, between anybody, this is the greatest problem. What is the problem? See, there are vast differences among human beings according to these qualities. So everybody will not be the same. The expectations will not be the same. If a teacher wants to train his students, all of them equally in the same way, he will be a failure. If we observe the life of Sri Ramakrishna, we can see what a marvelous teacher he was. First of all, his relationship with his students or with his disciples was one to one. With each individual, he adopted a very special relationship. That is first. Secondly, even before accepting their responsibility, he studied their character. And he gave instructions so that they can grow according to their own nature. The devotees of Sri Ramakrishna know the incident as an example. How he instructed differently to his disciple Yogananda and to his disciple Niranjanananda under the same situation. Briefly, one day one of these disciples was coming to Sri Ramakrishna by a boat, and some people in the boat criticized. So the disciple was what you call a kind of tamasic type of person at that time. So he thought, these non-devotees, worldly people, what do they understand Sri Ramakrishna? Let them talk whatever they like. After all, if they talk, what does it matter? He simply kept quiet, came to Sri Ramakrishna, reported the matter, and expected a pat. What a great holy man you are. You behaved like a holy man. Sri Ramakrishna immediately scolded him. What? Your guru is criticized? You should have killed them on the spot. Or you should have run off from the place. And then this disciple was taken aback, because that action that he did was not the highest action. It was an unspiritual way of reaction. Sri Ramakrishna wanted him to correct. Now observe this. Another day, another disciple was coming by boat. Exactly same thing happened. And the people in the boat, they criticized Sri Ramakrishna. The moment this man heard Sri Ramakrishna being criticized, he got up, started rocking the boat, and said, "If you don't apologize, I am going to drown this boat. All of you will die." And he was so strong, so ferocious. And everybody got up and then apologized. And they would have even licked his feet if he had wanted. And then he came and reported the incident to Sri Ramakrishna. And this time Sri Ramakrishna's reaction was totally opposite. He said, "What does it matter if people talk of me in whatever, what is your headache? They criticized me. What was your headache? What a great sin you were about to commit. What did the poor boatman do? It is only few people who create the trouble." You know this, how human nature, how it works, you know, if somebody does something wrong, we just do not point our fingers only at that person. If he belongs to an organization, we point our finger at the whole organization. And if he happens to belong to a religion, we point out fingers at the whole of that religion. You know, this is our human tendency. If the mistake is committed once, we say that always you are committing this mistake. You know, once a couple came to me and the wife was complaining, my husband is very angry with me. He scolded me very much. What was the problem? That, you know, he says, you know, you don't know how to cook. You have burnt the lentils preparing. So the husband also was there, unfortunately. So I asked him, how long are you married? He said, more than 30 years. And how many times did your wife cook for you? He said, almost every day. And how many times did she burn these lentils? No, just 4 or 5 times. He said, but what did you tell her? Always you don't know how to cook, always you burn the lentils. You know, that kind of generalization in anger is very bad. This is what human beings do. So Sri Ramakrishna told Swami Niranjanananda, but what did the innocent passengers in the boat do? What did the poor boatman do? What wrong did he do to you? You were about to drown the whole boat for the mistake of few people. Anger is very bad. You should never react like that. What? They are ignorant people. What do they know about you and me? Even if they criticize, what does it really matter? You know, totally different reaction. Why? Because for this person, his quality is rajoguna. If anybody tells one thing, he will give back 14 times. I mean, what we say, you know, if somebody scolds, uses a harsh word against me, then I will mention 14 generations of his. Sri Ramakrishna used to give an example, you know. One gentleman was being shaved by a village barber. And you know, that barbers talk a lot. I don't know why. So this wild, you know, he's talking this and that, and then he nicked a little bit of the skin. This man, being a bit English educated, he said, "Damn." Now the barber didn't know what was the meaning of damn. He asked the gentleman, "What is the meaning of the word damn?" The gentleman said, "No, no, it doesn't mean anything. You see, barber has a knife." At that moment, "Oh, it doesn't mean anything." But the barber was not one to leave him at that. He said, "If the word damn means good, then damn me, damn my father, damn my 14 generations. If it means bad, damn you, damn your parents, damn your 14 generations." So human beings have always this tendency to point out either a country or, you know, for example, Iraqians or Muslims or Syrians. Do you think there are no good people there? There are, in fact, bad people are always very few in number. But then, since we cannot make any distinction, and we always point out to people in this way. This is called irrationality. Only a sattvic person, a person who has grown spiritually, who has developed rationality, what is called balance in life, calmness, objectivity, such a person alone is capable of reacting to things properly. So our point is that relationships, there is conflict because there is conflict between these in irreconcilable types of qualities. Always, without understanding them, if we each one look at our own point of view, there is bound to be this kind of stress. So Swami Vivekananda has started his topic of the second chapter, "Each is great in his own place," that these are the three qualities. In different men, one of these qualities or forces is generally predominant. Karma Yoga has specially to deal with these three factors. By teaching what they are and how to employ them. It helps us to do our work better. Proceeding, he says, human society is a graded organization, always hierarchical. Even if there are two people, there will be one superior and one who is not superior, his assistant, like that. So we all know, Swamiji says, about morality and about duty. But at the same time, we find that in different countries, the significance of morality varies greatly. What is regarded as moral in one country may in another be considered perfectly immoral. I'll give you beautiful examples. You know, the word morality evokes sometimes very pleasant kind of memories, but very often very reactionary type, unpleasant type of memories. So many people these days, they do not attend church. Church attendance is very poor. Why? Because the priests there, they are supposed to be sermonizing. What is the sermonizing? 10 commandments. You know, do this, don't do this. Any organization is identified with this kind of sermonization. That is why people, they rebel against parents, they rebel against organizations, because they think organizations only do this and don't do this. They command, they're authoritarian, they're sermonizing. But there is a good point also. Every organization is there to protect certain values, to inculcate within a certain values, to propagate and safeguard certain values. So, but morality, either are universal moral principles are there, which would not change from the beginning of creation to the end of creation. They are called universal moral principles. They would never change. They are called in Sanskrit sarva kalina, for all times. For example, truthfulness, unselfishness, love, these are certain moral principles which would not change. A time will not come and you say, okay, in those days truthfulness was morality, but in these days untruthfulness is all right. No, it won't change. In those days unselfishness was considered to be very moral duty, but nowadays, you know, you can be selfish. Now it won't change. In those days we can love each other, but now you don't need to love each other. And no, even in this, loving is a moral duty. In fact, without love there would be disease, either physical or mental disease. It's a wonderful, wonderful discovery being made these days. One great psychiatrist has written a book, Beyond Freud, Beyond Prozac. And in that book he is mentioning one very wonderful teaching, that there is an inherent need within each one of us to love and to be loved. We are hardwired to love and to be loved. He gave an example. You know, there were at one time in hospitals, a lot of babies were dying, especially premature babies. They what they used to call, the nurses, funnily, little shrimps. Little shrimps. They were dying in huge numbers. So the doctors, you know, with modern medicines, they found out how to isolate these people, and they were put in small glass cases. And there's big notices, do not touch them, feed them with, you know, through gloves and through tubes and all that. So one doctor, in one hospital, they were having hundreds of these babies. And to their great surprise, that many of these babies never survived more than few days, in spite of they were being kept in the most hygienic conditions, being fed with the best food that could be given to those kind of premature babies, and they were taking the greatest scientific care. You know, the hospital has many wards looking after these hundreds of babies, and there was one ward and a new nurse was appointed there. And to the great surprise of these doctors, they found out that the babies in that ward, they were growing up like normal babies and thriving, not dying. Whereas the babies in other places, in spite of all the best care, they stopped growing normally. They shrunk and then used to die. So somebody found out why in that particular ward babies were thriving. Then they found out the one reason was there was one particular nurse who was appointed very recently, and it is in her ward this. So they called the nurse and questioned her, that what were you doing? She was hesitant at first to reveal the truth, and then she said, look, that I cannot bear, these babies used to cry, this heart-rending cry, but then big labels, do not touch, because unhygienic. I could not resist. So when nobody is about, I used to remove the lid, and I used to pass my hand over their backs for a few seconds, and immediately the baby would, you know, just gurgle, and then you go to sleep very happily. And this, then she thought, I have touched the baby, maybe the baby will die today or tomorrow. But to her great surprise, she found nothing happened. On the contrary, the baby was, you know, thriving. So she started doing it to all the babies. Then the doctors were forced to admit, what was the difference between the other wards and that particular ward? It is this loving touch of this woman, even though they were babies, they knew somehow there is someone who is caring for us. This is a great lesson for all the mothers or would-be mothers, that don't put on glove and try to pat your baby. Take it with your hands, even crush it, and she will be all, the baby will be all right, because what they want is love. They don't want food and other things are secondary. Primary is love. Now, it is not easy to love, because you see, we always want to love people who behave according to our expectations. And our expectations are conditioned by our guna. If we are tamasic people, then we love tamasic people. You know, Jung divided people into two categories, the introverts and the extroverts. The introverts, they do not want to go outside, meet people and do all those things. The extroverts don't want to go anywhere confined inside. They want to go into the shop, into the street, meet people. Wherever there are two people, these extroverts would run there. Now, if an introvert is married to an extrovert or forced to behave like that, what would be the condition of their relationship? Whether it is relationship between parents, between parents and children, between husband and wife or colleagues, this is one of the greatest conflicts, misunderstanding about the gunas. So that is why in Hindu marriages, you know, they have a way of finding out what they call gana. I don't know how to translate it into English. The boy and the girl must belong to the same guna. Gana is guna. So for example, rakshasa gana. Rakshasa means demon. If a boy or girl is born in a demonic, and then if that person is married into some other, married to another partner, born in some other group, then there is likely to be a conflict, friction. That is why if one demon is married to another demon, both are extremely happy together. So these are the duties, morality changes. Another example is, some time back, a survey was done to find out what is the concept of morality among the modern youth, especially adolescents between 15 and 20. Older type generation people like me, for us morality means, you know, immorality means illegal, immoral affairs, having connections between men and women, unmarried, and all those things. So here we think that that is what is sinfulness, that is what is immorality. So these, some journalists started asking questions, these young people. Is it immoral if a boy and girl have affairs without marrying or even after marrying? They said, no, this is just normal human nature. As it is nothing, it is immoral. It is neither moral nor immoral. It is just like drinking a cup of coffee. That's it. In which shop you drink a cup of coffee, it doesn't really matter. Then in your opinion, what is immorality? And immediately, most of them said, if you cut down a tree, that is immorality. If you catch fish more than the allotted quantity, that is immorality. If neighbors make too much of noise, that is immorality. You know, the concept has changed so much. Whereas if you ask Ramakrishna, oh, you eat a little more fish, what does it matter? You cut down one or two trees, what does it really matter? But this, what is called immoral sexual connections, are considered to be the root cause of all these problems. So, the duties change and the concept of moralities also change from place to place. Another example I give you. There was a tribe and they also had what you call taboos. What is taboos are based upon their concept of what is moral and what is not moral. So, in that particular tribe, if a man is having an illegal, immoral affair with another woman, not his wife, then it is not too much of immorality. What is the greatest immorality? If anyone in the tribe steals a little bit of food from his neighbor, that is the greatest immorality. Now, why this particular emphasis on food? Because food was very scarce for them. So if food is stolen, that family is likely to die. And if families die, the tribe also is likely to be die out in course of time. So protection of food, production of food, protecting of food, that is the most moral thing a person can imagine. So that changes there. Swami Vivekananda is telling us, what is the purpose of morality? Why should we be moral? Because morality is the step by which we will become spiritual. So karma must make us people of character. It must help us to develop character. If we become men of character, then we become moral automatically. And our concept of morality depends upon what stage we are and what is the next stage. One example would be Gita. Now in Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna, who was the commander-in-chief, and he came to the battlefield and he said, I don't feel like killing. Killing is immoral in my opinion. So I would like to become a monk. And Sri Krishna almost called him, you are a hypocrite. You are a hypocrite. You think one thing and you do something else. Suppose, for argument's sake, Krishna said, oh, you are a wonderful holy man, so you don't want to kill anybody. Okay, become a monk and go and sit under a tree. And Arjuna happily goes back and dons ochre robe, sits under a tree. What do you think he will be thinking? God? He cannot think of God because his mind is full of ambition. He would be regretting also, oh, I should have killed Duryodhana and all his brothers and all that. Only thing is, physically he is not doing it, but mentally all the fight he is doing it. This is what is called hypocrisy. So Sri Krishna taught him, no, you discharge your duty. But the same Sri Krishna also tells, suppose Arjuna has become 60 years old and his children had grown up, and they are quite capable of looking after the kingdom or family or whatever, and Arjuna need not go to the... If he says, oh, I will go and fight somebody, then Sri Krishna would have condemned him and told him, you are an old man. Now your duty is to sit and think about God. Sri Ramakrishna's gospel. There is a story, you know, one day he went with Swami Akhandananda to the Ganges to take a bath, and a 65-year-old Brahmana had come there, and he met the manager of the temple in the Ganges river, and he was asking, how much fish do you get from your pond, and how much money do you make out of the selling this fish in your pond? Sri Ramakrishna got very annoyed. He was looking daggers at that man, didn't say anything. So they both of them came, returned to his room, and this Brahmana shortly afterwards came to Sri Ramakrishna's room to inquire about somebody. Where is that some person? Instead of answering, Sri Ramakrishna looked at him and said, "Look here, you are a Brahmin and you are 65 years old. Is this the time? Is it not time for you to think about God? Instead, you are asking about fish and how much money they are making and all these things." But the man simply got very much annoyed and he ran away from the place. But Sri Ramakrishna's view is, this is an age when one has to direct the mind more towards God. So the idea of duty, the idea of morality, change all the time. But what is the purpose of this morality, of this duty? Because karma yoga is expressing ourselves through our duties, through becoming morality, developing certain principles. Morality is the condition of the mind, and duty is the expression of that mindset in actual day-to-day circumstances. So he says, what is the goal? The goal is freedom. The goal is to become divine, to have self-knowledge. So Swami Vivekananda says, two ways are left open to us. The way of the ignorant, who think that there is only one way to truth, and that all the rest are wrong, and the way of the wise, who admit that according to our mental constitution, are the different planes of existence in which we are. Duty and morality may vary. The important thing is to know that there are gradations of duty and of morality. The duty of one state's life, one state of life, in one set of circumstances, will not and cannot be that of another. In this connection, Swami Vivekananda raises one of the most important topics. Every religious teacher teaches us one thing, one teaching. What is it? Resist not evil. Now, by evil, always we think somebody else is evil. There are two sets of evils. One is personal evil, another is evil in the outside world. There are evil people, there are evil circumstances. Is in this world all sorts of things are there. But there is also what is called evil in us. The concept of evil has to be thoroughly analyzed and understood. Supposing you come back, you means a devotee of a spiritual aspirant, come back from office, and then you are planning, I will have a little bit of tea, and I will take 10 minutes rest, and then I will sit for meditation and think of the Lord. That is your plan. So you come home and, you know, just to have a bit of relaxation, and you open the TV, and what is happening? A wonderful cricket match between India and Pakistan is going on. I know, I am giving this illustration because I know people who used to come regularly for the class here, many times they don't come because of this football match or cricket match. So, this, what will you do? You know, it's, you know, meditation can be done at any time, but cricket game, it is not going to be at any time. This is very interesting. So what happens then? Resist not evil. So why? I am a good man, I am a spiritual person, why should I resist evil? No, I won't resist evil. and you will sit there and you will watch for 3 hours, 4 hours, and then the time comes for you to sleep, and you go to sleep and say, tomorrow I will make up for it. Tomorrow. There is a shop, you know, in Calcutta. It is called Tomorrow. A shoe repairer. So he says, by tomorrow everything will be repaired. So one man had given him his shoes. And he went next day and asked. He said, no, come tomorrow. Your shop says that by tomorrow it will be repaired. That's what I mean. By tomorrow it will be repaired. Come tomorrow. This will never come. Who knows what is going to happen? We may die tonight. So resist not evil means do not give in to weaknesses, temptations. Spiritual life means gradually overcoming the weaknesses, making the will very strong, manifest the divinity. We are always looking how to resist, and it's important because many of us, when we read news about Saddam Hussein or about Hitler or about so-called evil people like that, we get very righteously indignant. And then say, oh, they are very evil people, they are making other people suffer. But from the Vedantic point of view, that's a very wrong way of looking at things, because who after all is Saddam Hussein, or any evil person for that matter? He is not an individual, he is a collective representation of all of us. He is a representative of us. If we are not bad people, then we would not get him. Swami Vivekananda used to say, you know, Indians, Hindus used to feel, oh, we are very pious people, and these evil British people came and conquered us, and then they put us under their shoes and robbed us and all that. Swami Vivekananda said, thank your stars, they came and liberated you. You deserved them. This is what is called collective karma phala. You have put all these, you know, so many millions of human beings, you labeled them as untouchables, gave them untold trouble, and you never allowed them to come up. You just put them under your shoes and then tried to smash them. Now the Divine Mother is giving you the punishment. It is not punishment, it is to make you a better person. There are two sides for everything. So the point I am trying to make is, if there is an evil leader, so-called evil leader, who is responsible for that evil leader? All of us, all the people of that particular community or country or religious organization, they are responsible. So you cannot simply evade and say, we are very good people, that person is a bad person. So the point I am trying to make is that if we want to resist evil, then we must have that power to resist evil. So Swami Vivekananda says that first of all, you develop that strength. Evil. So I will read from Swamiji. All great teachers have taught, resist not evil, that non-resistance is the highest moral ideal. We all know that. If a certain number of us attempted to put that maxim fully into practice, the whole social fabric would fall to pieces. The wicked would take possession of our properties and our lives and would do whatever they like with us. Even if only one day of such non-resistance were practiced, it would lead to disaster. Yet, intuitively, in our heart of hearts, we feel the truth of the teaching, resist not evil. This seems to us to be the highest ideal. Yet to teach this doctrine only would be equivalent to condemning a vast portion of mankind. Not only so, it would be making men feel that they were always doing wrong and causing them scruples of conscience in all their actions. It would weaken them, and that constant self-disapproval would breed more vice than any other weakness would. So, what is the way? Swami Vivekananda says, first to develop that power to resist evil. First resist the evil in yourself. Become a better person. Then resist the evil outside you. When you have that power to resist evil,
then wisdom will also come to you, how to not resist any evil. There are illustrations. One illustration I will give you. There was one person, a great saint, and he was stabbed by an enemy soldier. And he knew who stabbed him. So when his friends came and asked him, "Who stabbed you?" he said, "It was the same Rama whose name I am taking, who stabbed me." This is a wonderful, wonderful concept. This man, he was a soldier. He was fighting. And yet when somebody stabbed him, he would not reveal the name of that person who stabbed him. He developed that highest power. He could resist evil. He could have resisted this man. But he did not, because he was looking upon everyone as a manifestation of God. Only when we know how to look upon everyone as divine, then whatever we do will not be resisting evil. We do not look at anything as evil. But as long as we think and see evil, then we have to resist. The idea is that a saint doesn't look at things as we ordinary people look at. If somebody is killed, then in our eyes that is evil, and especially if it is unjustified. But in the eyes of God, in the eyes of a saint who is God, it is not evil. It is a leela of God. And so he will not resist it for two reasons. One reason is he doesn't know what is evil. The second reason is that he knows that whatever is happening is the will of God, and it is the best that can be done under the circumstances. So then how do we develop this? So Swami Vivekananda says that do not feel weak. And weakness often expresses itself in the form of self-hatred, self-pity. You know, one of the greatest diseases, mental diseases, modern man suffers from is self-pity. To the man who has begun to hate himself, the gate to degeneration has already opened, and the same is true of a nation. Is it really possible that we can hate ourselves? Swami Vivekananda says yes, and it is very true. If we are suffering, if we are having stress, if we are wallowing in self-pity, if we are having what we call negative thoughts, depressing thoughts, and anxiety, depression, these are the greatest diseases that are suffocating many, many people, especially in the Western world. What is the cause? Hatred is another word, self-hatred. Not only that, it is said that a few types of diseases are the direct cause of self-hatred, especially two dimensions, cancer and rheumatism. These are the causes of, direct causes of self-hatred, self-suicide, suicide. A person feels, oh, I have no life. I want to die. I have no joy in life. This thought somehow triggers the process. I'm not saying that is the only cause, but that is one of the causes. So Swami Vivekananda says, our first duty is not to hate ourselves, because to advance, we must have faith in ourselves first, and then in God. He who has no faith in himself can never have faith in God. Therefore, the only alternative remaining to us is to recognize that duty and morality vary under different circumstances. Not that the man who resists evil is doing what is always and in itself wrong, but that in the different circumstances in which he is placed, it may become even his duty to resist evil. And Swami Vivekananda says in this connection, because we are all at different stages of gunas, at different stages of life, under different circumstances, our duties vary, our morality varies. Therefore, one of the greatest teachings of Swami Vivekananda is, each is great in his or her own place. And he illustrates this with a beautiful story. Very briefly, the story is, there was a king, and he had a doubt, who is great, a monk or a householder? So, one day, it so happened, a monk was passing that way. The king asked the monk this question, and the monk said, for a few days, you come with me, live with me, and I will show you the answer. So the king left his kingdom, and then he followed him. While they were wandering, they came into a city where the princess of that city was supposed to get to choose a bridegroom of her will, and so many bridegrooms were parading themselves, and she was rejecting everybody. There was a young monk who happened to pass by. This prince's attention was attracted to him. She went and then put the garland on his neck. But the young monk said, what is this nonsense? I am a monk. I don't care for this kind of thing. He threw away that garland and started going into the forest. The princess started following him. So the monk said to the king, let us follow, what will happen. Very soon, the monk, he disappeared in the forest. The princess was inconsolable. And so they took that girl also with them. And by the time it was night, they took shelter under a tree. And suddenly there was a family of birds on that tree. And there was an imaginary conversation going on. The head of the family was telling, my dear, guests have come. They have to be looked after. So I will bring a little bit of fire and you wait. So he went and brought a little bit of fire and threw it where there were some dry wood and leaves. Very soon there was a roaring fire and there was the cold was lessened a little bit. And then he said, I have to feed them. It is my duty as a householder. He threw himself into the fire. Then the bird, wife of the bird also threw itself. Then the children of that family also threw themselves in that fire. And this monk was telling to the king, look, this is the answer to your question. Each is great in his own place. If you want to be a monk, then be a monk like that, who rejected even the most beautiful princess as though she were a straw. But if you want to be a householder, then you be like these birds who sacrificed themselves for fulfilling their householder duties. The point Swami Vivekananda is telling is most telling, that there is no need to compare ourselves, to feel superior and inferior. All of us are great in our own place. A child is great, a student is great, a married person is great, a monk is great, a man is great, a woman is great, a clerk is great, an executive officer is great, a servant is great, a king is great, a poor farmer in the fields is great, and the emperor on the throne is also great. Each one is great in our own place, which means do not compete, do not compare. We accept, let us all accept whatever position we are in and try to do our best, what is called our duty. And then nature itself will evolve us into higher states of being, and a time will come when we will become free. Just as a monk becomes free by renouncing everything, a householder also will become free if only he discharges his duties in a spiritual way. Each is great in his or her own place. This is the gist of the second chapter of Karma Yoga of Swami Vivekananda. The third chapter, which is very important, Secret of Work, we will discuss in our next class in the new year. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.